Hello, and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars, artists, and others about research and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I am very delighted to have back on the show today two guests with whom we've spoken in the past on different occasions, and now we're talking with them together. They are Adam Michaels, founder of Inventory Press and principal of the design firm Project Projects, and Jeffrey T. Schnapp, co-director of the Berkman Center for the Internet and Society at Harvard, and faculty director of the Harvard Graduate School of Design's Knowledge Design Studio, MetaLab. Jeffrey is also a Vassar graduate. Adam and Jeffrey are talking with us about their co-edited reprint of Maurice Stein's and Larry Miller's manifesto, Blueprint for Counter-Education, originally designed for Stein and Miller by Marshall Henricks and published by Doubleday in 1970. Blueprint was republished this year by Inventory Press in the original boxed form with an added booklet of commentary. And this will be the first interview this academic year in our continuing special series on the value of the liberal arts in contemporary society. Hello, Adam and Jeffrey.
Hello, Tom.
We usually think of reprints as something at the duller end of the publishing spectrum. They were very popular in the 60s when there was a great need for them, when institutions were expanding exponentially all over the country and to some extent the world. And there was a need for out-of-print materials, and so there were publishers who really went into the reprint business. It's also, you know, a way a publisher can make money on an out-of-print item just by bringing it back without having to do a lot of editorial work. But in this case, this is a sort of glamorous publication as a republication, as exciting as any politically au courant art installation. And I'm not the only one that thinks so. It's got a lot of great press already in the art world, and the Walker Art Center recently featured it as part of their fabulous hippie modernism exhibition. And, you know, maybe this has to do with the fact that there's a real need for political engagement on campuses as the problems of our society spill over on campuses and students feel they need to do something again. And it may be the nature of the subject matter, which is modernism and the allure of modernism yet, which is still the environment we dwell in, both physically and intellectually in the 21st century. In any event, I can't think of another occasion where a reprinting of a title constituted a cultural event in and of itself. So I wonder if either of you have any thoughts about the reprint here as a form of expression, and in this case as a kind of curatorial or cultural act.
Maybe I can jump in first and then I'll hand over the answer to Adam. But we were both really excited by this idea of not just reprinting a document that was a really powerfully expressive document in its own time, but augmenting it and updating it in the process, but doing so in a way that was respectful and, in a sense, extended the original design program of that document. And, you know, Blueprint for Counter-Education was published in 1970. It was the expression of a radical experimental pedagogical project of the late 60s, and it reached a relatively small audience in its own time, even though it had a significant impact. And it really felt like a document that needed to live a second life, particularly in the sort of context that we live in, where, you know, there's some profound ways in which educational institutions are shifting under the pressures of socioeconomic shifts, shifts in models of communication and culture. And I think Adam and I both felt that it was both a document that belonged to its own time, but that also spoke to our time. Mm-hmm. And so the expanded reprint concept was really meant to be both faithful, in a sense, to that original object and also a kind of reanimation, very much rooted in the present, of this radical project from the 60s that seemed to us very much of our time as well.
Well, and I would add that it's sort of interesting that it wasn't our first idea to do this expanded reprint as the form for our investigation into Blueprint. We sort of started talking about various exhibition ideas, and there were some like multimedia ideas that have happened in various ways also, but I think we did sort of find ourselves coming back again and again to just how strong and compelling and sort of strange and interesting the original object was. And even we'd have these conversations a little bit further into the process where we realized that it would be difficult to find money to do this particular one. So there's all kinds of nearing moments where we're like, well, it's a miniature version, or we could do a version of three posters in a Ziploc baggie or something. And but the result of every one of these conversations was, the original is just such a strong thing that we really just need to wrestle with the logistics to figure out how to put that in front of people again, because there's a lot that's interesting to do in terms of commenting on it, but just the form and the format of it in the first place is so unusual and worth, we certainly thought, worth bringing back into the world.
Yeah, it must be selling well because it's a kind of must-have for, I think, institutions that are collecting in the area of, well, educational history, certainly, but also just the political history of the 20th century. So,
I mean, we've definitely, on the publishing side, it's been really exciting to just be presenting the publication to people and seeing immediate interest. I mean, just very recently, we had our inventory press table at the New York Art Book Fair and had the posters on the wall there and had the opportunity to very directly get feedback from people who would just walk by, didn't know what the project was, they'd see the posters and, what is this? This looks amazing. and a lot of people did walk away from the table with the publication.
Oh, that's great. That's fantastic. So part of the reason the book appeals, I mean, apart from its content, is the design, I'm sure. And that is very contemporary in a sense, too. I mean, as an art librarian, I see formats are not always conventional formats anymore. You know, they're just codexes with color plates. Things come in all sorts of shapes and sizes, often boxed like this. So it sort of, you know, fits in with what's coming along. Difficult from a librarian's point of view sometimes to find places to keep this kind of thing, it's sort of kind of bordering on the artist's book, a box set like this. So did this appeal to you then as a design object? Because Adam, I know you're a designer, and Jeffrey, you're at the Graduate School of Design there at Harvard.
I mean, definitely immediately the design is super compelling, and I think, you know, and it does stem a little bit, our interest in it stemmed from this earlier project Jeffrey and I had done, the Electric Information Age book, where the material in that book and Blueprint shared this interesting characteristic of being sort of wildly unusual projects that somehow snuck through very official mainstream publishing channels. You know, it's one thing to sort of see, you know, 100 of some handmade artist book and sort of understand the production issues or conceptual issues and sort of point together something on that sort of smaller scale, but to navigate the unconventional through much broader channels is particularly fascinating phenomenon to me. And I mean, I guess it sort of almost comes through, you know, growing up in like punk rock culture of the 80s and 90s and witnessing a little bit what things sneak through from the underground to mainstream culture and seeing how changes can actually take place as a result of something underground piggybacking upon broader distribution networks. I'm almost thinking of like Sonic Records coming on FM.
Yeah, if I could just add to what Adam was just saying, I think one of the things I think that really attracted our attention that came out of the research we did for the Electric Information Age book and led directly to the expanded reprint of Blueprint is this sense of excitement in excavating this moment when mass communications were in such a tight dialogue with forms of experimental culture, both in the case of some of these, you know, this early generation of televisual paperbacks that Agel and Fiore and others collaborated on, but also in the case of Blueprint, you know, we have Doubleday, a publisher we don't really associate with artist books or with experimental books, publishing a box set where the, in a sense, the core text is three posters, three wall-sized posters, designed by Marshall Henricks, who, you know, was a book designer who had worked for Doubleday, but who was brought in on this project to kind of translate a pedagogical practice that started on blackboards, made it to note cards, turned into a series of charts. The charts then became literally blueprints because blueprint machines could print the largest possible reproducible sheets that were available to the authors of Blueprint, Mari Stein and Larry Miller, and then are turned into these, you know, really kind of lively, jarring, spectacular wall posters boxed into a set with a so-called shooting script. Mm-hmm. It just seemed like such an amazing convergence of forces that would be hard to imagine really after the transformations that publishing undergoes in the 70s.
Yeah.
And maybe even hard to imagine today.
Yeah.
And even just on a formal level, I mean, you know, I've been sort of a student of graphic design history for however many years, and I'm very hard-pressed to think of something that actually looks quite like these posters look.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they certainly incorporate any number of techniques that stem from constructivism or Dada or whatever, but it sort of actually comes from Maury and Larry's unusual approach to organizing information on those charts then takes this super unusual graphic form. So it's also just a really interesting example of unconventional approaches to content and unconventional approaches to design coming together in a way that is super, super rare to come across.
Yeah, they seem to be certainly conscious when you look at them. I mean, they remind me of Dada and futurism also to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in fact...
It's like the density of information is the thing that's so unusual about them.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think Larry and Maury really came out of, much like McLuhan, I might add, out of a kind of cultural context where their points of reference were, you know, vorticism, a kind of letterist, if you like, mm-hmm. aesthetic that shaped their approach to information design. And, you know, what Marshall Henricks did was to translate that original paradigm into a language that's much more resonant, I think, with the graphic culture of the late 60s, you know, where you can see a really strong hand of pop art, of certain forms of commercial communication, and the whole counterculture, graphic culture. This was an era when posters had a really powerful resonance, both in the streets and in people's domestic spaces.
You mentioned Maury and Larry. Who were Maury Stein and Larry Miller, the forces behind this? It's hard to call them authors because it's not quite, you know, it's not quite, they're not quite conventional authors, but magicians, I suppose.
Well, so Maury Stein is an American sociologist.
Mm-hmm.
He was a figure who emerged as a powerful voice in the 1960s, mm-hmm. largely thanks to a couple of influential publications, an edited volume entitled Identity and Anxiety, a subsequent volume in 1963 entitled Sociology and On Trial. And he was a sociologist whose main commitments were to the area of community studies.
Mm-hmm.
He became involved in the 1960s in the anti-war movement and other social and political movements of his time. And unlike a lot of his peers, one of the things I think that really is at the roots of Blueprint is that his own pedagogy became completely infused by the task of bringing different traditions of critical thought in sociology into conversation with the contemporary,
uh-huh.
you know, with what was happening every day. Literally, the newspaper headlines of the day were often the platform on which he would build his own teaching. And Blueprint came out of that attempt to somehow bring the great traditions of critical sociology and cultural sociology into direct dialogue with, you know, what was unfolding day by day, week by week, year by year on the immediate stage of American life. And Larry Miller was his student in mm-hmm. one of the main courses that he taught at Brandeis. He was a faculty member at Brandeis starting, I think, in the late 50s and would spend most of his career teaching at Brandeis, even after the Blueprint era.
Mm-hmm.
And Larry, who himself became a sociologist, teaches as a faculty member at the University of Massachusetts as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
And Larry became really engaged in this project of trying to think of a model of critical sociology that would also translate and be in dialogue with forms of engagement with the present. And Larry became the sort of partner in crime, the co-curator of this project of bringing Maury's blackboards, which were famous for their labyrinthine complexity and graphic density, you know, developing forward as a platform for this alternative model of sociological and more broadly humanities and social science teaching.
Very interesting that it comes off the blackboard as a medium because, you know, the blackboard is a sort of medium that's halfway between, you know, consciousness and print. It's such a fluid medium, you know, you've got an eraser in one hand and a piece of chalk in the other. and this is print, but it captures that. You don't get a sense everything's entirely fixed here, and that it's meant to be interactive even. And you know you're looking at a snapshot also, not something that's meant to stand for all time. Although, as you say, it still stands for us. It can stand for us, certainly as an artifact.
Yeah, I think you just touched upon a really fundamental part of the project that I think attracted Adams and my interest as well, and that is precisely the way in which the posters were not imagined as a kind of point of arrival, but rather as a sort of platform for activating the reader's engagement. And as the shooting script, which is this kind of document that it's a paperback that's inside the box set, is meant as a kind of guide to how to use the posters, says repeatedly, make your own posters. Mm-hmm. These posters are not there for you to study them as if they're a map. They're there to serve as a kind of point of departure in a learning process that's completely learner-centered. Yes. It's completely driven by the reader, by the person who hangs them, who builds this virtual classroom.
Yeah, and that's the hope of people using today's technology to some extent, isn't it? Education should be student-driven in a sense, although the technology doesn't always lend itself to that. It's kind of rigid and prescriptive. But
precisely.
So there are two institutions that figure in this story of Blueprint for Calendar Education and the story of Miller and Stein also, Brandeis and CalArts. So I wonder if you could talk more about Stein at Brandeis and the genesis of Blueprint?
The genesis of Blueprint is very closely connected to his teaching, especially in the second half of the 1960s at Brandeis, where he famously taught a couple of courses that were large enrollment courses. The sociology of literature was one of those courses. And that's where he met Larry and their collaboration began. Mm-hmm. And basically, those blackboards that were typical of this experiment in pedagogy that he carried out in such courses became the note cards and the charts that eventually turn into the posters of Blueprint for Calendar Education as a formal publication in 1970. So the ties to Brandeis are very deep, but I should mention that this method of teaching was not limited to his classroom at Brandeis. It was also a roadshow, and he and Larry would go to other institutions and run a kind of teach-a-thon where they would produce and distribute in blueprint form the charts that they had been working on together as an extension of this pedagogical experiment.
And then what about CalArts? Stein and Miller migrate there to become administrators?
Yes. Well, the blueprint came out in 1970, just as really at the time that Murray Stein, along with Larry Miller, because they went together to CalArts, Murray as the dean of, essentially the dean of the humanities program when CalArts was first founded, and Larry as an associate dean who was part of the larger team there. And even though Blueprint wasn't literally the curriculum for the new Arts Institute, it played a central role in its shaping and in the basic pedagogical concepts that informed CalArts in those early years. Mm-hmm. And apparently the posters were hung in the bookstore at CalArts as sort of icons of guides to
what to buy.
Exactly. The bibliography that one should engage with as an art student in 1970.
Yeah. One of my things that I talk about in my soapbox often is the fact that students don't go to the bookstore now and peruse the shelves to see what people are teaching and reading before they choose their classes. They don't have that anymore. You can do it sometimes with some institutions, to some extent online, but it's not exactly like looking to see what novels and poets and you know, critical works are being taught in a given class. And faculty used to do that with one another. You know, the bookstore in and of itself worked a little bit like these blueprints, and that's gone now. So it's interesting that they were hung in the bookstore. So, at CalArts at the time, anyway, great artists there, you know, Nanjun Paik and their whole slew of people. It must have been a place of ferment, although the institution had been started by the Disneys, yes, so it had started out sort of conservative, and it didn't stay that way for very long. It still isn't. I mean, you know, it's still known for its contribution to the whole notion of interdisciplinarity. So certainly Stein and Miller have a kind of legacy there.
Yeah, I mean, CalArts was really, even though funding for CalArts was largely Disney money, to Walt Disney's credit, the ambition really was to create a new kind of art school, an art school that would bring together the best traditions of experimental art with, of course, the needs for commercial artists, for artists who could be animators in Disney studios, for a kind of engaged public-facing, if you like, mass culture-facing model of artistic practice. And basically, Mari Stein was brought in to lead that process. At least he was the dean of what was called critical studies, which was basically the humanities core. And as you said, the original faculty of CalArts was pretty much a who's who of West Coast art at the time. It included Alan Capra, Herb Blau was one of the other deans, Mort Subotnick, the experimental composer, was another colleague. And in that early period, there was tremendous energy and vitality around this initial community. Mari Stein and Larry Miller's tenure there didn't last very long. Mari tried to hire Herb Marcuse in his second year as dean of critical studies, and that didn't sit very well with the trustees of CalArts at the time, and the adventure was soon over. And Mari, as well as Herb Blau and several other key players in the first year or two of CalArts, were dismissed rather precipitously and ended up, in the case of Mari, he ended up heading back to Brandeis subsequent to that experience.
Marcuse is one of the poles on these charts. Marcuse is on one side and Marshall McLuhan on the other. And I wonder if you could talk about the content then of the charts and the way they are organized, because they have a cosmological aspect to them with these two with these two gravitational forces around which you know, other names sort of spin and shoot off.
Yeah, I think if one were to try to really sum up in a nutshell what the project of Blueprint is and what the project of the posters is, as an exercise in idea mapping, or you know, I'm not sure if that's the best description, but it's something like that. Yeah. It really is to bring together two different strands of thought that didn't typically communicate with one another or viewed often as in conflict with one another. One is the kind of tradition of critical thinking embodied by Herbert Marcuse, and certainly, you know, Marcuse as a kind of figurehead associated with the Frankfurt School and the tradition of critical social science work that we think of in relation to the Frankfurt School, you know, figures like Adorno and Horkheimer and the like, you know, which is a tradition of critique of capitalism, critique of forms of industrial and mass culture. And on the other side, that newly emergent strand of thought associated with Marshall McLuhan that had a, even though it was often critical of a new and emerging media and culture, nonetheless always had also a kind of celebratory strand that saw the emancipatory potential for mass culture. I mean, McLuhan didn't start out an enthusiast, but over the course of his career, as he moved beyond the mechanical bride to understanding media, and then himself became a kind of mass culture celebrity. Yes. McLuhan's thought, I think, gradually embraced those forms of mass culture, the sort of new media of the late 60s. Mm. And I think what Mari Stein and Larry Miller wanted to do in Blueprint was really to bring together productively, even with all the tensions and frictions between those two strands of thought, those two traditions of thought, to bring them into a kind of productive collision. And Blueprint is that collision.
Yeah, interesting. Funny, we don't hear Marcuse's name much anymore. I mean, at one time, it was probably read more than McLuhan himself, or as much. I mean, when I was an undergraduate, everybody was reading Marcuse like everybody was reading Khalil Gibran, you know. I mean, it was one of the critiques, I suppose, of Marcuse that was made at the time was that, you know, he's a flash in the pan, and unfortunately, in some ways, you know, McLuhan still has a cachet, certainly, and people still read his books, but Marcuse, not so much anymore. So I wonder if he's due for a resuscitation.
It's an interesting question. I think there is a renewed interest in Marcuse's thought. He certainly, you know, much of what you just said, I think, could be said of McLuhan as well. I mean, McLuhan himself was kind of eclipsed. His work was critiqued very powerfully over the course of the 70s and 80s and beyond. And yet there's been a kind of return to this period. And I think with Marcuse similarly, there's some of his works, I think, that are attracting renewed attention. But I would certainly agree that of the figures who came out of that Frankfurt School tradition, he certainly hasn't aged as well as, say, the work of Adorno, for example. But that said, I think some of the aspects of his work that involved a flirtation with Freudianism, an interest in surrealism, an interest in the emerging liberation movements of the 60s, they have a kind of currency that I wouldn't exclude the notion that there might be a kind of renewal of interest in some of the key works that are a product of that flirtation, particularly the Essay on Liberation from 1969, which is a kind of celebration, as well as a critique of the limits of the liberation movements, of, you know, the anti-war movement related to the Vietnam War, but also other similar kinds of insurrections in the private sphere. So in short, perhaps they were at the beginnings of a kind of renewal of interest in Marcuse.
Yeah, well, the times are very demanding that we live in politically, and for a young person, there has to be a desire to get out there and do something. And, well, for us, it was always in those years, reading in the library, you know, Keats or, you know, Coleridge, whomever, didn't seem somehow relevant to what was going out on the street. And I'm sure students are feeling that again. Mm-hmm. And there is, you know, if you read the shooting script, there's something very Dewey-esque about the emphasis in this book on the relation between art and experience, especially the experience of events happening out in the world. And I found that to be a great positive about the work, because at least by implication, it gives art a purpose, you know, a political purpose, insofar as art becomes an agent of positive change. And it also does this for us in the academy, in a way, in our interpretive role and connection-making capacity. So, you know, it gives a role in the world to teachers who have the potential to function as agents of social reform between events and ideas, I suppose. So it's very exhilarating. And, you know, when I think back to the 60s and 70s, to those years, and remember how socially engaged educators were, and students also, it's something that would be a fine thing to bring back big time. So, and I wonder if this was part of the excitement for the two of you of this publication, the connectedness here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, I think also that's where design is such an interesting field, because it actually does bring... you know, you have the capacity to bring, you know, everyday life aspects together, the academic aspects, the you know, text, image, all of these different realms of experience and knowledge you can sort of synthesize into, you know, a kind of concrete form, as, you know, something like Blueprint does so nicely, and bringing the political impulse into something that's physical and it's sort of immediately tangible. So, yeah, definitely the political running through all this stuff is super significant.
And maybe just as a footnote to what Adam just said, it's worth underscoring that Maurice Stein, during his shift from sort of more conventional academic sociology to this focus on radical pedagogy and experimental pedagogy in the 60s, was really committed to exactly this. He was engaged in a critique of academic sociology and a turn precisely towards this idea of somehow rebuilding a bridge between the immediate life challenges, experiential opportunities, you know, emerging forms of contemporary culture, and the world of critical discourse, of history, of academic inquiry. You know, Blueprint was meant to be a kind of classroom in a box for people who wanted to build those bridges, to create forms of engagement between high-level forms of expert knowledge and public debate and political practice and immediate experience.
I remember reading a passage, and I couldn't find it when I went back, but it described, I don't know if it was in Maurice Stein's introduction, a typical student's day might be studying the problems with the criminal justice system in the morning, and in the afternoon throwing bricks at cops in a riot on the streets. So all part of the liberal arts experience.
Exactly.
So, you know, you mentioned the critique of education, especially higher education, which is a big part of this. And it reminded me, when I was reading it, I've been thinking lately about Clay Christensen's theory of disruptive innovation that still seems to be on some people's minds, especially academic officers at many institutions have drawn on this theory, from my perspective, as an excuse for downsizing. You know, it's supposed to be innovation, but it basically allows you to cut programs, you know, with the idea that if we bust things up, it'll make room for something new here. So, you know, it justifies curricular cutbacks, and all based on this sort of vague prognostication about preparing the ground for change. That seems to be dissolving a bit now, happily, now that the academics are looking hard at it. And I'm thinking of, at Harvard, Jill Lepore's historicist appraisal of the theory back in 2015, and MIT Slow Management Review just weighed in with a special issue that takes disruption theory apart systematically. And I don't know, you know, if you're going to redo these charts. Charts are about change and the history of ideas. If disruption theory would even make the chart, it's not really a theory of social evolution or history, but of technology and its relation to capital. So the question is, were either of you thinking about this and the kind of revolution that people are trying to foster in higher education now against this earlier attempt from the 60s and 70s at changing higher education dramatically into something more useful?
Yeah, certainly in my case, the answer would be yes, in precisely the sense that the project of Blueprint really was to, in a sense, it really was about the kind of institutions of higher learning that we dream of, that we want, as a critique of the kinds of institutions of learning that we actually operate in, that we actually exist in. And this classroom in a box was really meant to extend the project of the kind of genealogy of spaces that Stein and Miller were committed to furthering, the kind of lineage of the Bauhaus, the lineage of Black Mountain College, and of course CalArts, in a sense, becomes a continuation of that story, to try to realize what they viewed as the radical transformative potential of modernism as it evolves over the course of the 20th century. And, you know, I think about this a lot as somebody who's run a series of research labs, first at Stanford and now at Harvard, of, you know, how we make the most of these extraordinary institutions that we have the privilege to inhabit, where there's so many forms of knowledge and learning and so many different kinds of skill sets. How do we make them really matter? You know, how do we transform all this domain expertise that we possess into actionable things, into practices that realize their potential in the world. And so for me, the project was attractive from that standpoint. I'm sure Adam has his own version of this, this same set of points of engagement.
Yeah, it's part of the reason it's so incredibly timely from an academic perspective.
Indeed.
Yeah. I mean, everybody's talking revolution, but let's go back and look and see what revolution really looks like. Probably, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
For me, it is just also the idea of that sort of modernist art school lineage intersecting with the context of Brandeis and sociology and the liberal arts setting. I mean, as someone who attended art school and, you know, our academic classes were somewhat lacking in my otherwise wonderful art school environment. It's super interesting and exciting just to see there being these moments where these worlds that feel very separate from each other can intersect. And
yeah, very much so, yeah.
And, you know, and even like when you look through the references within the shooting script, like it's pretty fascinating to see Typographica in there, which is a pretty typographic sort of research magazine produced at that time by Herbert Spencer. It's something that even the hippest New York graphic designers of the 60s might not have been aware of. So just that it's on the desk of these lefty sociologists in Massachusetts is a pretty fascinating thing. And I asked Larry about that specifically, and he was moonlighting a little bit as a typesetter to help to pay some bills when he was a student, I think. And just sort of naturally became interested in learning more about that particular field.
So apart from the charts, there are these other pieces of things in there, including Thomas Schmidt's questionnaire, which is quite wonderful. And Kurt Schwitters has a timeline. And so it's really a box full of wonders, isn't it?
Yeah, and maybe just very much to this point of the extraordinary range of the materials that are included. As you mentioned, the shooting script, which is this paperback book that's part of the box set, actually not only includes instructions for how to activate the charts, but it also includes this kind of collage of other elements. Thomas Schmidt comes out of the Fluxus context. So there's a direct tie-in to contemporary forms of, you know, avant-garde and experimental culture. The Kurt Schwitters timeline, which is by Tamerson, who himself was a really active figure in these sorts of experimental art, culture, publishing circles. But then also the whole last two-thirds of the shooting script is a kind of library of tables of contents. It's a we could call it a database, because that's sort of what it is. It's a sort of database avant la lettre. And what it does is it creates a library not only of text that you might have found on Maurice Stein's syllabus for his Sociology of Literature course, but also works that capture a lot of really super contemporary forms of experimental practice, as mm-hmm. Adam mentioned, in fields of graphic design, in political theory. It captures an incredible range. And I think what Blueprint really sought to do was to kind of create this really critical but alternative model of how to integrate disciplines, mm-hmm. integrate domains of practice. And what the box set does is put them all together and then extend an invitation to the reader to do something with
it. Yeah, it's really quite wonderful. It makes my librarian's heart, kind of jump up when I see all those tables of contents all stood up. You know, because it's very visual. You know, you can just sweep your eye over the whole of it and sort of scan and, you know, all these names, and you get a sense of the depth of it all. And it is a database. These things link out, of course. And it's a big part of education, not just staring at the text in front of you, but knowing how to connect to all these other texts. I mean, I tell my students that the most important thing they can do when they start out in a course is go through reserve books and read the acknowledgments of everything I observe. So as a librarian, you know, if I look at the Blueprint, I see a couple of patterns, things that jump out at me. And we didn't talk about this, but there is a critique of modernism, and I look at the whole of it as an attempt to sort of resurrect the best part of modernism and steer it in a direction other than the direction it's going. So, you know, I see two patterns. First, there's the critique of the academy for its betrayal of the humanistic promise of modernism by basically bureaucratizing it, incorporating this bureaucracy within itself. So Stein critiques the traditional academy for its emphasis on objectification and classification over his values, which are participation and creative engagement, both with life and ideas. And I look at the field these days, and I see this in academic librarians, where the profession is becoming more and more instrumentalist and bureaucratized, in a sense, as bibliography and a knowledge of content seems to be becoming a kind of thing of the past. And I hear every day the word assessment over and over again, almost as a way of trying to convince ourselves that we're both being scientific and we're still relevant to the communities we serve. So I found Thomas Schmidt's Dadaist survey absolutely hilarious, you know, the information gathering, because we're always doing surveys anymore, and I guess it's absurd most of them. But you know, on the other hand, the Blueprint captures for me what we were just talking about, the essence of what librarians do, bringing ideas into alignment with people's needs, you know. Something that public librarians especially still have a sense of. David Lankes at Syracuse defines a librarian as a radical agent of positive change, something Maurice Stein would probably like a mm-hmm. phrase he would like. So the Chucks, you know, represent a kind of interactive library, and the Shooting Script is about, for me, what it means to be a librarian, getting to know both the scholarly record and the needs of the community, both of those in a dynamic way, in order to facilitate some kind of matching and sorting that need to take place if ideas are to become useful. And then, of course, design, as Adam knows, is exceedingly important to this program in bringing memory and imagination into conjunction with people as a agents of progress. So the question I guess I'm kind of working toward here is, do either of you think the Blueprint might still serve as a blueprint, in this case, for future libraries as well as for education in general? I mean, can it help us become better at organizing and delivering cultural memory? And I suppose, Jeffrey, that's to a great extent your business with the Library Test Kitchen and what you do at mm-hmm. Harvard there, isn't it? So.
Yeah, I think that was certainly one of the aspects of this moment that gets embodied in the box set publication that attracted my attention from the beginning. And I think, you know, if there's a lesson that is immediately applicable to the sorts of challenges that institutions of knowledge like libraries face today, I think it is indeed a lesson about the importance of design, of interfaces, of points of engagement, bridges between the world, this vast and, you know, almost intimidatingly expanding universe of information and the actual embodied social world that we as learners, as people who need to access that information, inhabit, on how we build productive bridges between the two. And I think the lesson in the case of Blueprint, one of the lessons, and I'm sure Adam would have more to say about this, is, again, this way in which Blueprint is about process, not about product. It's not about beautiful series of vintage posters, but those vintage posters themselves were meant to be a kind of portable, do-it-yourself classroom that is seriously engaged in merging domains of knowledge activating them locally, adapting them to immediate needs, making them actionable and serviceable, not just relegating them to some kind of abstract realm where they exist as a potential or they exist in storage.
Yeah, I guess a hesitation that we might have had in doing the reprint was to sort of see it, put it forth as this historical relic and something that is just this fixed thing in time. I mean, it really is a big part of the thinking behind it is to put it forth as a model for hopefully current production. And, you know, and we thought about that in a few different ways, like maybe there'll be some sort of workshops or classes that will be developed, hopefully put together design students with liberal arts students and have not necessarily try to visually match or replicate the structure that was produced in the original blueprint, but see it as a point of departure and something that can be built upon to incorporate all those decades of knowledge that have come together following the original 70s publication. And I mean, the other thing just about the idea of blueprint, but also just books in general, the thing that's so wonderful is the way that they just distribute far beyond the walls of the institution. And clearly Blueprint is so much a product of Brandeis and these particular academic settings, but you know, you like figure only so many people get into Brandeis and only so many people can attend or can afford to attend. So, you know, the premise, you know, that what the package of Blueprint does is pulls together the results of really the best example of what can take place in a setting like that and then broadcast it out to, you know, anyone who might just stumble upon this pretty strange, compelling object out in the world.
Yes, it's a pre-network type of open education.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, I think from the beginning, that was what drew the two of us to it. And as I think Adam mentioned earlier, we didn't necessarily start out with the idea of doing an expanded reprint edition. We had thought of the project as focused on a series of installation pieces that might activate the posters and make them a kind of immersive environment. Yeah. But we kept on coming back to the strength of the object as a physical object. Mm-hmm. And I think we ended up with the notion of a kind of expanded reprint that stays true to that graphic project, but then adds to it, adds another brick to the wall, so to speak, throws another brick.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm talking about what the fourth poster should be, or the fourth or the fifth poster, whatever, because a few people were very conscious of, you know, music is not actually make its appearance. We see some mentions of various bands and so on, and some of the note cards that Larry scrawled out or Maury scrawled out. But so that's a sort of like notable missing topic, or even just feminism is missing in a pretty major way, and was something that was certainly in the midst of what's going on in that moment in time. So there's, you know, you can find all these things that are missing and easy and quick to come up with.
So it has an archaeological value, of course, but also the motto here would be that often is in these conversations I have with the two of you especially, that the past isn't over, you know, which is a good motto for a librarian, I suppose.
Just one thing I would add, when Adam was referring to the opportunities today for bringing, in a sense, extending this conversation between design and forms of scholarly knowledge or different traditions of inquiry, and I'm actually teaching next semester a course where I'm going to use Blueprint in a design studio seminar hybrid that I'm teaching. It's a course entitled What Should or Could Scholarly Knowledge Look Like in the 21st Century? I'm calling it a knowledge design seminar. And in that seminar, I'm actually literally going to be pairing together PhD students from different humanities programs at Harvard with design students from the Graduate School of Design to work collaboratively on different kinds of experimental iterative projects of how we might translate forms of traditional scholarly inquiry into new expressions, use different kinds of experimental methodologies. And so I think there's a way of not just treating the expanded edition as a little monument or philological homage to an interesting media archaeological moment from the past, but also to build upon it our own forms of experimental practice that respond to opportunities that are specific to our own time. So for me, it certainly has more than archaeological value in precisely that sense, that my own pedagogy is, I think, largely a pedagogy that's trying to find interesting new hybrid models that are not entirely dissimilar from the kind of ambitions that informed the original project in the late 60s.
Yeah, it sounds fabulous. So I'd like to thank the both of you for spending the time to talk to us about Blueprint for Counter Education today on the Library Cafe.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your interest.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. It was a pleasure.
Same here.